I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. This is one of the rarest of times doing this program where it would suffice for me to say my guest now needs no introduction. Chris Hadfield joins me now. He is the author of the big hit in this country and beyond, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. It's a terribly engaging book, providing insight into the life of one of the more fascinating, exciting, and certainly accomplished figures in the country and the international space community. There was a great review of the book in the Wall Street Journal a week or so ago by Adam Savage from the program Mythbusters. Quote, "The vacuum of space is unforgiving and brutal. Life on Earth isn't easy either. Mr. Hadfield has genuinely and refreshingly increased our understanding of how to thrive in both places." ChrisHadfield.ca is the website for more, and of course the Twitter handle is @Commander_Hadfield. The book is published by Random House. I am very pleased to welcome to the Plant on the Line program from Toronto today, Chris Hadfield. Colonel Hadfield, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. Thanks to talk with you.
Thanks for joining us. So I read last week that Monday is the last day of your Canadian tour. Then I look on your website and see that you're going over to England and Ireland. Will you be spending the holidays there?
No, I'll be speaking to people in England and in Scotland and in Wales and in Ireland right through till Christmas, but then I'll be back home for something I'm really looking forward to, and that's the whole family together here back in Canada for the first time in 26 years. The whole family back together here in Christmas. It'll be really nice.
Yeah, that's great, yeah. The training to go into space is pretty intense and grueling, and we see that depicted in this book of yours. Did any of that prepare you for the past several weeks of this book tour? I mean, it's taken you across the continent, back and forth again.
Well, book tours are really pleasant. I mean, you don't have work to do in between. It's not like before where I had a job as an astronaut with all of the demands of that, and then I would go speak at schools and talk to media and do all the other things, in between. I'm very much enjoying the book tour. It's a chance to relax and talk to people, and it's been very pleasant.
Now, this book seems to have come together pretty quickly, because I guess you came back to Earth in May. But are you happy, though, that a lot of people are picking up the book and reading it? I mean, a lot of people have talked about how it's inspired them.
The book has been in works for years.
Oh, I see.
If it seems to have come together quickly, I guess that's delightful, but it's not right. I mean, my wife and I talked about writing a book a long time ago, and then we started working on it over 2 years ago. Of course, there was a tremendous amount to add and update and modify and include after the 5 months in space on my last space flight. But the book was not written after, it wasn't conceived of after landing or something like that. Books take, I've never written or authored a book before, but books take a long time.
Yeah, but I mean, it must be quite nice to have people. I mean, the reviews of the book have been great. And people themselves have been buying it in great numbers.
Yeah, it's the number one book in Canada, and a New York Times bestseller, and it's doing wonderfully in the UK, and I think it's already in 10 other languages, I think, in other countries. So yeah, it's had an enormous reaction, which is really delightful. I set out to write a useful book, and it's very much, Joe, the product of all of the talks I've given, mostly in Canada, but around the world, at schools and everything for the last 21 years as an astronaut, a recounting and an insight into the life and the stories and the adventures and the bizarre occurrences of being an astronaut, but very much with a purpose, with the intent that what is useful out of it all. It's not just and then a funny thing happened to me on the way to the space station. It is a whole compendium of events, but hopefully then trying to draw out of those something that is worth remembering or something that is worth thinking about when faced with a typical human situation. And it was, I never wanted to just go to schools and be a unicyclist. I wanted to go there and have to be entertaining, but entertaining with a purpose, so that the students would come away maybe thinking slightly different about the opportunities that exist for them or the horizons that they saw as limitations in the past. And of course, a lot of people, it's not their interest. But as you say, I'm really delighted to see the immense interest and response in the book right now, because because to me then it shows that people are finding the book useful, which is delightful.
Yeah, the book provides marvelous life lessons for life on Earth. One of them is how to anticipate problems in order to prevent them. Now, how do you expect the worst without succumbing to, say, hypochondria?
Well, it's completely a mindset, right? Yeah. Hypochondria is a irrational fear, and the key is to, why am I afraid of whatever X? Why am I afraid of being sick? Why am I afraid of men with mustaches? Why am I afraid of something? Why did that bring up the hairs on the back of my neck? And yeah, everybody has choices, right? You can decide to just stay afraid, you know, and not, you know, just avoid those things. If you see someone walking up the street at you who has, I don't know, has a Hell's Angels jacket on, you may have a fear of Hell's Angels people, and you cross the street to avoid them. Or you walk next to someone, you know, big enough to deal with it or whatever. Or you may look into the actual details of what it is you're afraid of. You know, you're not actually afraid of whatever, Hell's Angels. Mm-hmm. You're afraid, perhaps, of what might happen, the sequence of events, that, you know. And so how do you actually get yourself comfortable with a normal occurrence in life that is currently giving you fear? And to me, of course, to ride a rocket ship, that is obviously something that should cause fear. It is the most dangerous thing I've done in my life. And yet I did it 3 times, and I did it with complete calm and confidence. And it's because of the process that I'm allowed to do something that should be inherently terrifying, that the process by which I got ready for it made us confident and calm. It's not genetic. It is a preparatory process for getting around your fear to then be able to do something that otherwise you would have forbidden yourself to do, like just walking down the street, or not being hypochondriac, or, you know, flying a spaceship. And so I think it's purely an introspective and possible process for a lot of people. It's just a matter of thinking about it, of actually spending the time looking at the difference between unbridled emotion, or actually even unfounded emotion, and what your possible actions could be instead.
And then in these lessons that you impart in the book, I mean, they've worked obviously in your life. I mean, it equals for you a happier life, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It's like writing an exam where you know all the answers.
Yeah.
You know, most people are afraid of exams, and I've been terrified for some exams in my life because I didn't properly prepare. But there have been some exams that I was just like, let me at it. I know I've learned my stuff. I know what I'm supposed to do. I am prepared for this thing. I have looked at every example that exists. I've figured out everything that can go wrong. I've got my actions ready. Let's get at it. And you could apply that to flying spaceships, but you can also apply it to giving a speech in public, or going to see your father-in-law, or whatever. You know, it's just life, and it's kind of a personal choice of how you prepare for things that are expected of fear. And I think you're better to go through life calm and optimistic rather than worried and fearful, you know.
Are there things that scare you today, though?
The my children to suffer, or my children to have not a full life, scares me, and it partially it scares me because I'm largely powerless to do anything about it now. Like any parent, at some point you have to let them fly out of the nest and go, you know, be adults on their own, and they are going to make mistakes, and they're going to put themselves in harm's way, and having been partially responsible for bringing him into the world, and having tried to give them the set of skills and values that they have that are helping them make value judgments, it makes me scared because even though I have a stake in it, I have no ability to influence it, or at least a very limited one. So those type of things bother me. A lot of other stuff I can just let go. You could let, you know, federal policy on something drive you crazy where you have absolutely no ability to sway it. You just decide to let that bug you, or someone else's religious beliefs, or whatever. you know, the person next to you snoring or something. You know, you some things you just have to accept that this is going to be, you know, what things are going to be, and you can't actually change it. But in my kid's case, I have a huge stake, and of course, and a great love, and that scares me.
No, I'm about the same age as your kids. I'm 31. What's their reaction when they see kids of varying ages looking at you as a hero? I mean, are they pretty jaded about that, or do they wonder what the fuss is all about?
It probably depends what age they were when you asked that question. But I think now that they're just a year or two younger than you are, I think they recognize that what people's opinions of me are based upon, and they are directly aware of how my wife and I raised them, and how much I was away, and how much the burden fell to Helena, my wife, and to each of them to try and have a home life. But they also recognize, I think, the good in it, the opportunities that have come their way as a result. I think for my all three of them, they're, you know, being the child of a famous person has advantages and disadvantages. You have access to things, you get to do things and see things and meet people and, you know, go to the White House or whatever. You get to do things that a lot of folks don't or would really like to. But at the same time, how do you define your own person when everyone else wants to define you as the son of or the daughter of? And they're all just like any 20-something person. They're coming to grips with their own adulthood and deciding who exactly they're going to be. And in truth, I'm really, Joe, looking forward to Christmas, to having them all here and have a chance to hear now, because with the huge success of the last year, the immense amount of work that my son Evan put into supporting this space flight and making it publicly known, and the fact that it was the genesis of the idea of my kids that led to a lot of it, and the direct support of my daughter, who did a lot of analytical work along with my son to try and figure out how to actually participate in social media so that it's as effective as possible. I think they have both a contributory role and living with the effects of that role. And so I'm really looking forward. I haven't seen my son since I left Earth, Kyle, the one that's in China. Uh-huh. So I'm really looking forward to having time to chat with each of them and see how they're doing and do my best still as their father to help them continue through life the way that's best for them.
Did they ever show any interest growing up into going into your line of work?
No, none of them did. And that's fine. I have no expectation or desire that something that I'm interested in and passionate about should be what defines their interest and passion. They're different people. My concern is that they are pursuing things that are of their nature and that they're interested in, and that they get enjoyment and satisfaction out of. That's and one of the hardest things you can give your children is confidence. And you know, I think it would be even worse if they had tried to follow directly in my footsteps, because then how are they forging their own path? So I'm proud of each of them and delighted to see their perspectives and takes on life.
What do you learn from being in space about some of the, say, critical challenges of our planet, chief among them climate change? I mean, you have obviously a unique perspective, seeing the Earth at a distance. I mean, that's the biggest problem nowadays, and I guess what ought to be our chief concern, right?
I don't know how you quantify the size of the problems facing humanity. I would bet there's a vast majority of people on Earth that would disagree with you that climate change is the biggest problem facing them. I would suspect hunger and war and lack of opportunity and poor governance and lack of future for the children is much more of a concern for the majority of people. I think climate change is definitely a problem, and it always has been. Climate's changed constantly. And part of it is natural, and now currently part of it is definitely, I mean, local climates have always changed. From the first time we started setting up farms thousands and thousands of years ago, we have had an impact on the environment. And if you only live locally, then all you really need is a local climate change to seriously cause problems. But we're to the population size now and the level of technology and standard of living now that we can actually affect the climate just by our very choice of existence. So, yeah, it's a serious problem, but it's not the only one by any means. You have to feed people. You have to educate people. You have to try and give people as good a standard of living as possible using the best of the technology that exists and somehow balance it all. And it's a serious problem. From orbit, it's difficult to see, just like it is from the Earth, to actually quantify verifiable human-made effects of climate change. There are some, the retreat of the glaciers in some areas, you could directly attribute them to human influence in some places for sure, like the deliberate drying up of the Aral Sea absolutely changed the lake effect that came off. That was the fourth biggest sea in the world. The Soviet Union decided, along with Kazakhstan, decided to dry it up in order to do irrigation policies of upstream rivers. It dried up an entire sea, and the snow belt that used to be downstream of it that fed the glaciers downstream is gone because now it's just a dried lake bed. And as a result, those glaciers are receding much, much faster than they used to or they would have. So there are definite measurable effects, and you can see that one from orbit. But the other ones, you know, the lowering of the Great Lakes, that may or may not be climate change. But it's very difficult to see that type of macro effect from orbit. Or the retreat of glaciers around the world. That one, you can measure it over time from orbit, but you can't just look down and see it. Whereas Mount Pinatubo, when it erupted in the early 90s and put millions of tons of sulfur dioxide into the upper atmosphere and radically changed the health of the ozone layer, that was directly visible with the naked eye. You could see the particulate when you look through it at sunrise or sunset, the layers, and almost like a prism of the upper atmosphere. You could definitely see that, and it cooled the world by a degree. So climate change is a serious problem. Part of it is natural. Obviously, we had glacier, you know, we had an ice age 15,000 years ago, so obviously the climate naturally changes, and obviously we changed the climate. You could see some of those effects from space, but trying to pick out the next steps, the logical things for us to do that can have as best an effect as possible for human welfare, which is the thing that we're most concerned about, I think, is difficult. And I've been focusing really heavily on being a good astronaut for the last 21 years, trying to be as successful as I can. And now moving back and settling in Canada after being away 26 years, I really see that I have a lot of study to do. I really want to become educated and informed on the topic so I can try and be part of the solution. And I'm thinking of going back to school on several different topics, including that one.
Yeah, that's the other thing that I came away from reading your book, and that is learning never ends, no matter what age you are.
I hope not. I mean, gosh, we have never had information more readily available to us than we have right now. Anybody can just take a little bit of time. If you have, you know, anybody in Canada at least, there is so much distribution of quality information. I grew up with encyclopedias. My parents went to the Canadian National Exhibition one year and went to one of those big pavilions and got convinced by the encyclopedia salesman that we should buy Encyclopedia Britannica. Yeah. And brought it home. And I used it all the time. I used to read through Encyclopedia Britannica and just look up topics. And when we had a discussion at the dinner table and somebody didn't know, we'd go grab that volume and look it up. But having an encyclopedia was kind of a privilege. Gosh, now the internet is so ubiquitous that anybody can look up anything, anytime, almost, at least in our level of civilization. And so the ready availability of information is such that we all ought to be learning all the time. You should never just go with your ignorant reaction. You know, as I've said, it's always far easier to believe something than to understand it, but it's never been easier than it is today to understand it, and I've always been much more in the comprehension part of that argument.
Now, the scientific benefits of the space program, I mean, that's something that we as people tend to overlook. But the advantages of that in terms of the advancements in medical technology, even just the gadgets of daily life. Those are thanks to the space program. Do you think that the public and the politicians are in the same place in terms of, say, the will to fund these programs in the future?
Yeah, it's interesting how you tie all that together as if it were a logical string when it isn't. Part of your question is, to what level should federal governments or other public entities fund research? That's part of what you just said. And the other part is, what are the benefits that we get back? And what should the taxpayer then decide to do? Because people tend to view the government as if it were an entity to itself. It is. We have a democracy. It's an elected representative of all of our decision making, and so whether we like it or not, we tell the government what to do, and if we don't like what it's doing, then every four whatever years or so we can elect a new government. So that part of it is, I think, the people need to understand what it is that they're spending their tax dollars on. The other side is what is the appropriate level of funding and how much has actually been spent. And that there's never been really a golden age. You know, people think there is. It's easy to look retroactively and think that the space program at some point was boundless. But people forget that even before the Apollo 11 landing, they canceled Apollo 18 and Apollo 19, even though the rocket ships were already built, mm-hmm. because of funding troubles, because of political troubles and cultural troubles. And every single year, it has been an edge of, a very difficult decision as to how much exactly to approve. The space station was made it through by one vote in the early 90s through Congress in the U.S. And Canada pulled out of the space station and then looked at it more closely and decided to get back into it again. So it has always been very closely run. And so as an astronaut, I've always asked myself, are we doing right by the taxpayer? Are we doing with their money what they're trusting us to do? And my answer every year was yes. And it's not because purely of the scientific returns that you speak of, which there are great examples of. I think, are you still there, Joe?
Yeah, I am, yeah.
Okay. I just lost the background tone for a sec. There are everything from Microflow, which is a wonderful blood testing technology that has real application to remote communities around Canada, right through to, if you just look at the long history of the Canada Arm, which we sold for profit to NASA, and now that invited us, has made our ticket on board the space station where we could spend the money domestically, which then led to NeuroArm, which does brain surgery with a surgeon in the next room robotically, where the actual surgical instrument is inside an MRI machine, so he can visually watch what he's doing or she's doing while they're doing brain surgery with much more precision than the human hand can do. You know, there are great examples like that where a scientific or engineering invention that was created for spaceflight then has had a really good and positive effect both on our economy and on the health of people on Earth. There's also just the fundamental necessity to explore, which is undeniable. And it's how everybody got to where they are in Canada. People vote with their feet. They vote with their dissatisfaction and try somewhere else. They go and do things because of the necessity to explore it. And we have always taken the best of our technology, our ability to build a chronometer or a boat that could make it through a storm or whatever, or an airplane or a luxury liner, and we've taken the best of that and allowed it to take us places that we couldn't go before. And so we are now inventing things that allow us to go vertically into space. So it's not like you're just going to stop. Yeah. It is. It's like saying in 1493, okay, North America's over there, but, you know, what are we going to do? You know, it's just a matter of inevitability that we're going to take advantage of our technology to explore. But I think the third part in answering the question is in the inspiration that it gives. And I get to see it more directly than anybody I know. I've been speaking at schools for 21 years across the country. And and talking directly to students and listening to their level of feedback and inspiration and interest and trying to help them see opportunities that they might not have known existed and having them make different choices in their life because of something that motivated or inspired them. It doesn't have to be the space exploration. Not everybody wants to do that, but a lot of kids are interested by it. And when I went and spoke at Hootsuite out in Vancouver, that's a really bright and wealth-making and interesting organization of smart young Canadians. And none of them are in the space business, and none of them are going to be astronauts, but they are motivated by it. They're inspired by it. It drives them to get higher education and to pursue and do things that challenge them. And that's the part that is necessary to remember. You have to challenge and inspire people to do things that are barely possible so that they will go on to take all the higher education and work on the inventions that otherwise would never happen. And so for me, it's all three of those things that I answered that your basic question with, is the scientific and engineering import, the inevitability of human exploration, and the necessity to inspire our youth so that they will stay within our own, stay Canadian, and do these things. And then we leave it up to ourselves to decide how much of our lucre are we going to spend on them. Yeah. And it's really Canadians who decide. And we don't spend much. We spend, you know, if you make it proportionate to whatever you want, gross domestic product or per capita tax income or something, we spend a lot less than Americans do, than the Russians do, than the Europeans do, and yet we get a tremendous bang for our buck. But all of, you know, it's a very tight economic time for the last several years, and government departments have been cut right across the board, including the space agency and in NASA as well, very, very heavily. And it's. But what do you do? If the government has to balance the books. They can't just keep funding everything at an unrealistic level forever. It's hard being a politician, and also they have to get elected every 4 years. It's difficult, and it's easy to just blame the government like it was one person or something. But if you look at the reality in the last few weeks, the government in Canada, in the last 6 months, they appointed a new president of the Canadian Space Agency, a really good person who has immense experience of leadership, of handling large financial programs, and who understands Ottawa, who worked there, the former head of our military. And so he's now president of the Canadian Space Agency, and last week, the government, in conjunction with him, announced that next year they will finally be releasing Canada's next long-term space plan. And that's vital, and that's a step we've been needing for quite a while. And they also committed to five, some of them a little esoteric, but some of them quite specific building blocks on which to show that support for the space agency is there. So in difficult economic times, yeah, of course we would like more money. We think we could get more done. I'm sure every government department would agree with that. And so would every school and everybody across the country. But if you look at the long history of it, we have done a tremendous number of things with the money we've been given and continue to do that. And working really hard with the money also. So I'm very optimistic about, as the economy hopefully works its way back up again, provides more money for the government to have a little bit of latitude in decision making. The indicators that they've just given here recently are really positive, I think, for space exploration in Canada.
Finally, Colonel Hadfield, when you're asleep in space, do you dream?
I do, but in truth, I think I'm the wrong guy to ask that question of, because I very seldom remember my dreams on Earth. And I don't think about them much.
I see.
It's sort of what are the pistons doing when the engine's idling? You know, it's just kind of like, whatever. I'm much more interested in what I think while I'm awake. And to be on board a spaceship is the ultimate daydream. It's the ultimate distraction of beautiful views and being weightless, which is pretty dreamlike all on its own. And being there on behalf of so many people and doing stuff that is the very stuff of dreams. So I know that I did dream in orbit. In fact, I think I dreamed last night, but unfortunately, I don't remember either of them.
Colonel Hatfield, it's been such a pleasure and an honor to talk to you today. The best of the season. Happy Christmas.
Same to you, Joe, and Merry Christmas to you also, and thanks for the conversation.
The website for more, chrishadfield.ca, the Twitter handle, of course, commander_Hadfield. The book is called An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. It's from Random House. Its author, Chris Hadfield, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.